HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Welcome to the Investor Hour podcast. I'm your host, Rahul Goyal. The goal of this podcast is to learn from the best investment minds of our times. We want to learn their backstory, essentially, what makes them, them. We want to learn how they make their decisions in their personal lives. And of course, we want to learn about their core principles of investing. Essentially, a lot of learning that could help you make better decisions in life and investing. Sankaran Naren, or S. Naren as he's generally referred to, has seen it all, right from the heady IPOs of the 1970s. Along the way, he has learned from his mistakes and combined that with teachings of gurus like Warren Buffett and Howard Marks to evolve his own unique approach to stock picking. He even has an acronym for it, TED. In our conversation, we talk about Naren's focus on buying what is bombed out and exiting what's loved a lot and how it has worked wonders. Finally, we talk about Naren's investment case for India. Listen in.
So, Naren, welcome to the Equity Master Investor Hour. Delighted to have you as one of our initial guests in the podcast. To take you back a little bit in history, in the early 2000s, I was involved in one of our group companies, and we were building out this personal finance advisory model, both on the internet and across the country. And those days, we would go and meet all fund managers. And if I remember, you guys used to have an office at Ballard Estate first.
Yes.
I used to go there and meet. And I'm kicking myself because I was still doing that job when you joined ICICI Mutual Fund, which is 2007, 2008, the year you joined. So I'm so happy to finally get to meet you. And at the same time, I'm wondering why I didn't get to catch up with you then. So once again, welcome to the Investor Hour.
My pleasure.
Wonderful. Great. So Naren, I want to go back right from the start. I want to understand, since I have not met you before, where do you hail from? Where do you come from in India?
I hail from Chennai. And okay. I grew up in Chennai in a suburb called Annanagar.
Okay.
Annanagar used to be the back of the beyond, in Chennai, okay, when I used to grow. Mm-hmm. And people used to think that Annanagar was the end of Chennai. And today, if you look at Chennai, Annanagar is possibly in the center of Chennai right now.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
That's the kind of development Chennai has seen from my days to today.
Yeah,
and that's where I stayed almost in the first 34 years of my life, except 2 years when I went to IIM. Otherwise, in the first 34 years of my life, I was in Chennai.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. So all your schooling and everything only for, because even IIT was Chennai itself.
Yes. I'd spent 3 years in Nagpur, mm-hmm. 4 years in Nagpur. Otherwise, I was in Chennai all the way till the age of 34.
Wow.
And almost entirely in Annanagar, actually.
Wonderful. So, and from there, then, of course, you went to HDFC Securities.
Yeah.
Which role was, I think it was in operations. You were like running a large part of the business.
Yes.
And there was a knock on the door and said, Naren, no, that's not what you have to do. You have to manage money. And that's when you moved to ICICI.
No, in between, I spent a year in Refco SIFI Securities, actually, as head of research. Okay. And before I moved into this role of in ICICI Prudential.
Okay. Refco SIFI was again Chennai based or?
No, it was Bombay based.
I remember a website called SIFI.com and all. I guess they were Chennai.
Yeah,
something like that. Anyways, so coming back to your growing up years. So tell us about your household. How was it like? What was the environment you grew up in? I'm trying to, like I always tell my guests, I'm trying to just get a sense and give our viewers a sense that what went into the making of our guest, in this case, you.
So I mentioned this before, actually. I lost my mother at the age of 14. So, you know, it was a two-member household, me and my father. And my father was interested in stocks. He basically used to invest in IPOs. And there
Which
were only...
was this? Can you give
this
us
was a... in 70s and 80s, you know. So that was way back. So, you know, there were two things which... In a two-member household, cricket and stocks became the conversation point in 80s. So, you know, and I didn't know much about stocks except that these IPO investment looked like lotteries. And lotteries are something which are always interesting. You know, if you get a lottery ticket and you make money, it looks like something enjoyable. And because it looked like a lottery and you learned about lotteries. So that was my initial learning about investing through my father. And my father was an engineer who actually learned finance, actually. And when he set up a business with two other people, both of them engineers, he took the role of understanding finance, accounts, taxation. So he knew much more about finance than his colleagues, and who are also engineers. So he taught me the initial rudiments of, I would say, finance. And it was absolutely interesting, although he also ensured that I became an engineer, for which I actually always tell him that what was the point in becoming an engineer from IIT Madras if I was never wanting to be an engineer. But I just found finance and stock markets just too fascinating that as soon as I finished my engineering, I went to do an MBA at IIM Calcutta and managed to stay in finance for the rest of my life because that is what I really wanted to be. So I would say that the real reason why I started enjoying stock markets was my father, who taught me the rudiments of stock market. And from there, I picked up what I wanted to and slowly learned the rudiments. And then from there, became more and more interested. So it's been a long journey for me, actually.
So in your family, there are two members. Your father, engineer turned, self-taught finance and became the finance person in his business. And you then?
Yes.
Engineer, and then you worked your way through finance. Wonderful. Very nice. So. Typically, when I'm talking to guests, and I'm only realizing it now, when I ask them this question, they usually refer to the period of the late 80s and the 90s. I guess I've had relatively younger guests so far. So do you recollect any names of IPOs your father was involved in? Anything you came across those days?
I think I remember a company called Cynamed, you know. I don't think the company exists today in its form. I think my father got an allotment at the rate at a price of some 25 or something like that. And the share quoted at some 300 or 400 rupees, just 25 shares. And
lottery.
You know, and it was a lottery. And, you know, it was a medicine which, and, you know, in those days, it was the Ferra company's dilution, which actually provoked the stock market boom in the 70s and 80s. And so I would say that it was the first learning actually always came from MNC dilution of companies. And that was what I remember from those days. And I was also interested in tea companies in those days. Somehow I found them interesting, but I later realized that they don't have moats, and I didn't make money subsequently, but it was interesting for me in the 80s at that point of time.
So, sorry, excuse me. You mentioned the Ferra related dilution. Now, I'm not, to be honest with you, I'm not familiar with that, but I'm aware of that phase where the Indian government was forcing companies to either sell out or out of India or reveal all the secrets. Was it related or was it something else?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, what happened was there were companies like IBM and Coca-Cola, I think, which walked out. And there were many other companies which actually diluted in India and actually started the stock markets in India at that point of time. And so many Indian companies are listed in the 70s. And 80s, due to this, whatever happened in 70s and 80s. I'm not fully aware of what were the laws at that point of time, but most of the consumer and MNC companies got listed and pharma companies got listed in that period. And they were all high return on equity, profitable companies belonging to big MNCs out of the world. And they were the first companies which actually started the equity boom, in my opinion, in India.
Yeah, that was a value investor's haven, if you will, in hindsight. I don't know how the value investors worked at it then, but in hindsight, that was the time to be around. When did you get around to making your first investment?
Clearly, this was after 1989 when I started working. And that was when, you know, my father knew my fascination for stocks and whatever little savings that he had, he had the guts to give it to his son and say, now try investing. And so in 1989, I had the chance to actually start investing with my father's money, because I obviously didn't have any money. And he was very happy that his son didn't go abroad and stayed in India and came back to work in Chennai. So maybe that was the reason he gave money to me to manage.
Do you remember where you invested your first, made your first investment? Was it an IPO? Were you also looking for a lottery?
You know, my father was actually a quality investor. So he told me, look for quality companies. So, in those days, it was Larsen & Toubro, I think, which was my first investment. Although wow. I always think my first investment was Lakshmi Machine Works, which was my first research investment, because I used to meet textile spinning companies and all of them used to tell me that we buy machinery from Lakshmi Machine Works. And, there used to be a 4-year waiting period. And when I went to my broker, a person called Murli Dharan from Vijay & Company, he told me, I hail from Coimbatore, but you can't make money in Coimbatore companies. And when I did my analysis on the company, and those days getting an annual report itself was difficult, I found out that the company was trading at 2 PE, price to earnings of 2, a company with a 4-year waiting period. So I jumped and bought that stock, and my broker actually told me, you can't make money in Coimbatore companies. And it turned out to be one of my best investments in my career. Ever. And it was based because at that point of time, it was a very unresearched market because foreign institutional investors didn't exist. People didn't understand balance sheets. People didn't understand price to earnings. There was no research analyst like you. So, you know, it was a very, very different market. And therefore, it was much easier for us to do research. And we were all some of the first few people who could understand balance sheets and look at it.
And, you know, you're being humble because of course, I was still in school those days, but I remember hearing enough stories of people buying the wrong stock and going bankrupt even then. So you obviously did something right. And whether it be Lakshmi Machine or L&T, that's a great start to a career as a first stock pick, right?
Yeah, the initial periods were good. But, you know, finally, what happens is what I tell people, you know, investors are prone to get into a hubris model. So while the 1989 to 94 was a good period for me, because in 1992 also I considered myself not knowledgeable and therefore didn't get caught in the Harshad Mehta problems. In 1994, after doing 4 years of investment banking in Hong Kong Bank, I felt I knew everything. So what I did, I quit Hong Kong Bank and became a stockbroker and made a lot of mistakes in investing in 94, 95. And that came out of a hubris saying that here I am, I am MBA, I have 5 years of investing experience. So I know a lot of things. And that led to a lot of mistakes I made in 94, 95. And that is because, you know, one of the biggest problems of investing is actually hubris. Mm-hmm. And a lack of humility. So one of the reasons why Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger turn out to be some of the best investors is the lack of hubris and the ability to be humble despite years of getting it right. And the hubris model is what leads people to making mistakes over a period of time in investing. Yeah. I had hubris in 94, 95, which led me to make mistakes. and had to pay the penalty in the 1997-98 Asian financial crisis.
So do you remember the Harshal Mehta period? Do you remember how it was? How did you deal with it? You obviously, you know, right in the middle of it. And
I was in the middle of it, maybe not properly, because somehow I did not participate in it. It something went like a rocket. And that was the year I got married. So, you know, somehow, thanks to my marriage, maybe I did. And the fact that I got engaged in April 1992 at the heart of the Harshad Mehta period, maybe I did not get sucked into Harshad Mehta. And I must thank my year of marriage for not making too many mistakes in 1992. All my mistakes were reserved for 94, 95 and not 1992.
Wow. So you owe a big thanks many times over, huh? For the 92 episode. And what happened in 94? Where did you get caught? Can you talk a little bit about the mistake you made? Some examples,
see,
perhaps?
It's actually a very simple thing. You know, I thought that price to earnings was everything. And I did not recognize quality. So what I did was, if I had a stock which was at 10 P, it went to 20 P, I would sell that 20 P stock and buy another 10 P stock. Again, that 10 P stock would go to 20 P. Again, I would sell that and buy a 10 P stock. But at the end of a bull run, the cheapest stocks are junk, which are trading at 10 P. So finally, I ended up having a junk portfolio. And the junk portfolio really performed disastrously between 1994 and 97-98. So one of the lessons that you have to learn is that as the market becomes higher and higher, actually you have to improve the quality of the portfolio, not deteriorate the quality of the portfolio. As the market becomes higher and higher, you have to move from small and mid cap to large cap. You can't actually move from large cap to small and mid cap. You have to improve the quality of the portfolio as it becomes costlier. You have to increase the capitalization of the portfolio as it becomes costlier. And you have to do all these kind of things as the market becomes bigger. Instead, I did the reverse. So as the market became higher and higher, all of us have limited capital. With that limited capital, you cannot deteriorate either the quality of the portfolio or deteriorate. And by saying, I'll buy small caps now, instead of having large caps. This was the learning that we had in 94-95, which we learned in 97-98. You don't learn it on the day of investment. You learn it a few years later that you have junk in your portfolio.
So talking a little bit more about quality, Naren. So I think it's for those of us who were exposed to Warren Buffett long ago, you were always looking for cheap stocks. Right, you're buying the cigar butt stocks, if you will, the 10 PE stocks or the 2 PE stocks. But somewhere there's been a shift where you know, you can actually still make good money by buying what the quality stocks, which are not 10 PE, they are more expensive. Do you think, and this is a question which has, you know, I've thought about this a lot and I don't have an answer, and I'm hoping you'll be able to shed some light. Is this switch, which is necessary, a function of, like you said, simply because of capitalization, as you grow, you have to move? Or is it a realization that in a country like India, where there are so many risks around, that you could still come out ahead by being in the expensive stocks, as against trying to find that hidden gem where, you know, which could be exposed to all kinds of risks that you may not even be aware of?
Warren Buffett says that you can't manage very large sums of money by being a cigar butt investor.
That's true.
If you are managing a very small sum of money, you can do cigar butt investing and buy the very, very cheap stocks. Otherwise, he says, finally, you have to buy good businesses at reasonable valuation. You can't buy businesses which are very cheap, which are not good businesses. That's what he says. And I think there's a lot we have to learn from Warren Buffett, but way back in 94-95, we had not learned many of these things.
Yeah. He also,
so, you know, it is only over time that you get to read many things. You know, in 94-95, we had not read many things.
Yeah. But he was also going through a learning curve, right? He did all the cigar butt investing himself. And then famously, as we all read the story, you know, Munger's introduced him to, like you mentioned, you know, it's better to buy a good company at a fair price than to buy a fair company at a good price, right?
Exactly.
So you think that by itself is a good strategy, and it's got nothing to do with the fact that, at least in a country like India, where there could be additional risks involved.
Yeah, I think clearly, I mean, we all have to learn from Warren Buffett. I think on top of it, you know, what you do is in 94, 95 kind of period, you take up leverage. So what happens is in a big bull market, on top of deteriorating quality, you think boss taking leverage helps. So, you know, you have to remember asset allocation, which is why in ICICI Mutual Fund, I have been at the forefront of telling people that you have to do asset allocation, because one of the biggest lessons that we learned from the 94 to 98 period was that as the market becomes costlier and costlier, you have to have money allocated to other asset classes like cash. Yeah. And you can't say I'll be invested in equity or be leveraged in equity or do a position in derivative segment and have leverage through that. So somewhere, you know, the fact is, forget just being in quality stocks. You also need to do asset allocation. And these are all simple principles people forget and say, no, I want to do stock futures. I want to do index options. I want to do Bank Nifty options. These are the other problems that people do over a period of time. Those turn out to be wrong. Yeah.
So 97, 98, you learned your lesson. And then I think within a couple of years, we had another meltdown. How did that treat you?
By that time, we had read Warren Buffett. We had read about, we had learned, we had created a group which tried to understand what kind of mistakes you should avoid. Then we realized that there is nothing called making too much money in a bull market. In a very big bull market, you have to turn cautious. These are all lessons we learned. So that, but you know what happens is to look foolish in a big bull market was the next problem. So in 1999, when we saw Himachal, Global, DSQ, Pentamedia kind of companies zooming and you staying out of it was the next problem. That's a learning again you have to learn. That you have to learn that when others are making money and you're not making money in a bull market, you have to know, yes, you have to sit it out. And that was a learning we learned in 1999, 2000, and we stayed out of it. And that helped us. Eventually, it helped us. But during a big bull market, to look foolish is also a problem. That's the new type of learning. You get the benefit after the bull market ends, but not during the bull market.
You have to have a lot of conviction to stick to a strategy in a bull market, because everyone's talking of how much money they've made, which is the next hot stock, and you're sticking to your strategy. So you're an outlier. It's tough.
You have to create a team around you. You have to have some friends around you. You need to have people with whom you can actually share the thought that you, it's fine to avoid making money at this point of time. And that learning actually helps, but you have to first do it. And once you see it work, once it's fine. That's why it's very important to see a cycle.
You've seen quite a few. So you're a veteran now. You know how the cycles play out, right? And you've evolved your style. So on that point, Naren, how would you define your style of picking a stock?
What happened is, like, you know, when since I now manage other people's money, and in large quantums, what happens is people give us money and we have to buy when people give us money. So, you know, essentially what happens is people can give us money when they want to give us money. And the experience, what we learned from 2007, 8, 9, which was another important cycle, was that they will give money when they want to give us money. So you have to learn to be a contrarian. So, in fact, with that framework at ICICI Prudential, we came up with this entire concept of balanced advantage fund, which was that when the markets are low, buy; when the markets are high, sell. And that framework turned out to be a contrarian framework. And that framework is what is most important. So, if you look at it, that framework helped us tremendously in March 2020. So when the markets were crashing in March 2020, we just stepped in and bought. So it is more important for you to know that any big crisis is an opportunity to buy, whereas any big market top is an opportunity to sell. And that is very, very important within sectors. For example, if metal sector falls to a very, very low level in March 2020, you actually see that as a big opportunity. If telecom sector crashes, you see that as a big opportunity. So any sector which actually falls very, very sharply becomes an opportunity to buy. And any sector which does too well is an opportunity to sell. So in March, April 2020, you find a way to sell pharma because pharma does very, very well. And you buy metals because metals has done very badly. And that kind of a framework, actually, we've kind of settled into where we look at cycles, we look at valuations, we look at how the sentiment is towards the sector. And that framework has we have found much more useful.
How do you deal with the emotion of selling at the top of the cycle? You know, becoming it's a little difficult, right? You always think there'll be another 5%, 10%, and similarly buying at the bottom. Do you have like a system in place which like guardrails where you just follow the guardrails? Or is it really a thought through process, in which case you have to really fight that emotion of greed and fear?
See, there are multiple things. One is we think in terms of switches. So one is we don't think in terms of selling. We think in terms of switches.
Which is a better stock.
So we sell metals, buy pharma. Sell pharma, buy metals. That's one. Second is, you know, we are managing now more than 2 lakh crores of other people's money in equity. So what happens is everything becomes gradual. So because of the quantum of money we manage, nothing happens on a one-day basis. Everything happens gradually. So it doesn't happen on one day. Anyway, we can't sell everything on one day and buy on another day. So everything becomes gradual. And these gradual models help us much more peaceful because at the end of the day, it's not one day that you can come out of everything. So, and we are now managing other people's money on a scale where anyway we can't do it on one day. So it is always gradual.
Systematic. It's automatically systematic for you.
It is automatically systematic. It removes a lot of the stress from us. So, and that basically becomes much more easy for us. So it's not as difficult as what it would be. For an individual, it may be much more difficult, but for us, it is much more easy because of the scale of other people's money that we manage.
So you spoke of switching, and this is a concept which I really, I think it's one of those thumb rules you can follow when you're looking at a stock. And because selling a stock can be quite a painful process, right? But if you're thinking of a switch that you can move to a better stock, you know, it's a relatively easier psychological shift. And I'm glad you said that. So can you talk a little bit about this? And, you know, I don't know whether you can give an example from history on how you did it and how it played out, because I think our viewers would really benefit from this. I think we all know, and I think I saw one of your videos, the rules for selling have to be, or switching have to be very clear. A lot of people don't make money is because they just keep holding on to stuff for far longer than they should. So if you can talk a little bit about that, I think that'll be very beneficial.
So it's what happens is what we noticed, you know, is that, you know, when we try to sell, we sell a share at 100 rupees, then the share goes to 110 rupees, we sell at 110. Then when the share goes to 120 rupees, we freeze because somehow we feel we have sold at 100, we have sold at 110. Now we feel we can't sell at 120 because we feel it'll go to 130. But the moment we say we are selling the share at 100 rupees to buy two shares of another company at 50 rupees, the decision becomes much easier. And that kind of framework is what we actually have worked on very, very frequently. And we have found that that framework actually works very, very well over a period of time. Because then what happens is the emotional problems of saying we sold at 100, now we sold at 110. Now, can we sell at 120? That problem doesn't arise because at 120 also we'll sell into that two. And now maybe we'll get 2.5 shares of that other company at 50 rupees if it has not gone up. So that kind of a framework is what we have found very useful. And over a period of time, you can see that if I've sold a share at 120 rupees, let's assume we are getting a dividend of 3 rupees in that company. Whereas if you're buying 2.4 shares of that other company at 50 rupees, and you'll get on that 2.4 shares, suppose you will get a dividend of, instead of 3 rupees, 6 rupees. it becomes very easy to justify. I have sold a share for 3 rupees and now I'll get dividend of 6 rupees based on last year's dividend. So actually it means my dividend will go up from 3 rupees to 6 rupees. So that kind of a framework becomes much easier for anyone to take a decision and becomes less emotionally difficult.
The bias, the ownership bias is terrible to deal with.
So it removes some of the biases of taking that sell decision. Otherwise, people just get caught in taking decisions. See, frankly, there are 3 important aspects of investing. One is the thinking behind a decision. The second is the, I would call it the execution part. And the third is the decision making. I put it actually, I call it TED. Actually, it is first thinking, then deciding, and third is execution. All 3 are important. In fact, for big fund managers like ICICI Prudential, the execution part is much more difficult. But for individuals, execution is very easy. So I would say that for a successful investor, all 3 are important. And people think that only one is important, but it is TED. It's like TED Talks. You've got thinking, execution, and decision making. And people think it is knowledge. Knowledge is less important than thinking, execution, and decision making. And most of the time, people spend in acquiring knowledge, but people spend lesser time on thinking. And that is where the problem comes, that people have to spend time in thinking. Because we have seen at various points of time, people don't spend that time on thinking. Event happened, how many people thought on that day that this can cause a big fall? Or after COVID happened, people didn't realize that one day there will be a vaccine and that vaccine will come and solve the problem. So if the market has collapsed, it will come back if you're patient. So people don't do that thinking. They get caught by various emotions of seeing what they see on TV rather than anything else. Let's say on the day after World Trade Center bombing, they think that the world is over. So somewhere you have to spend time on thinking, you have to spend time on decision making, and you have to spend time on execution. So as long as you spend time on TED, you can actually make money. But if you don't spend time on TED, you are not likely to make money. This is what we have learned over a period of time.
I can tell you everyone's going to remember TED from now on whoever watches this. It's a very nice acronym, and you know, I cannot be understated at all how important thinking is in the process. You mentioned execution is easy, but I think one of the reasons people end up in this situation, which is not very good, is because executions become too easy. So they can act on an impulse and they end up, you know, manifesting their greed and fear even more quickly than they should. So yeah, deal with your biases, think, and I guess the rest will hopefully fall into place over time. So, Naren, I had a chance to watch some of a presentation you had done. I think it was a CFA Society presentation. And I was pretty intrigued. Now, typically when if I was to ask someone, you know, what's Naren's style of investment? He'll probably tell me he's a contrarian. He's like a value style guy. And they'll tell me things like that. But when I was seeing the presentation, it's pretty clear you have a pretty unique style that you evolved, which is based on your experiences. But you also mentioned that you actually look at charts to make a decision. Talk to us about that. Because, and I want to add that because to a lot of value investors, the typical value investors, looking at a chart is equal to committing a crime. And from what I heard you say, it actually made a lot of sense. So I'm sure we can take away something from what you have to share on that.
See, in 2007, I was in my third year in ICICI, and you know, I used to look at charts, and I used to feel most of my colleagues used to say, "What is this, Naren, looking at charts?" So later, I read a book written by Anthony Bolton, who's one of the world's most famous fund managers of Fidelity, who had run Fidelity Special Situations Fund for a long time. Based on which we launched India Opportunities Fund as a special situation fund. So he said that, you know, one of the world's best fund managers said that I look at charts. And after that, I became less, I used to feel very bad telling anyone I look at charts. But once the world's best special situation fund manager said that, I said, first, I should launch a special situation fund like India Opportunities. Second is, I'm not going to be ashamed to say I look at charts. Wow. The reason is that once you see a chart, you know first whether you're buying after a big fall, you're selling after a big rally. Once you sell after a big rally, you have a lot of peace of mind. Once if you sell after a big fall, again, you have a lot of peace of mind. So this is something which, for example, gave us a lot of peace of mind. Just imagine you're on March 22nd, 2020, market has fallen 20%. On that day you buy, you have a lot of peace of mind. Because market has fallen 20%. If market falls 20% in 1 month and after that you're buying, you have a lot of peace of mind. Look at the chart before you buy. In January 2008, markets have gone up like a rocket. You look at the chart before that. You sell. Again, look at the chart before that day. It shows that the market has gone up like a rocket. So you can sell. Again, you have a lot of peace of mind. So what Mr. Anthony Bolton taught me is just look at the chart before you buy a stock. Look at the chart before you buy a seller stock. You will know how much of margin of safety you have in that. So, for example, when you buy metal stocks in March 2020, you look at the chart for years before that. Look at some of the public sector stocks which have moved in a period. You'll realize you have huge margin of safety. So, when you have huge margin of safety, the chance of you making a mistake is much lower. Similarly, yeah. Certain stocks have just shot up through the roof and then you're selling it. You have huge margin of safety. And that is what I learned by saying charts are not a bad time, but you have to look at countercyclically. I don't say that this has crossed heads and shoulders, this resistance, resistance is broken. Now the 200-day DMA is broken. Now market is headed. Simple common sense. Chart shows a ballistic rise, you can sell. If a chart shows a ballistic fall, you can buy. Simple common sense doesn't require anyone to know charts.
Yeah. And I think that it is yet another filter, if you will, which just, you know, not only strengthens your decision-making process, but like you said, it gives you peace of mind. You know what you're doing, right?
Exactly.
And you won't feel bad after that because you've got a margin of safety or you've exited at a peak point, which, you know, you shouldn't feel bad about. So pretty interesting. I hope the value investors watching this will take note of it and try it out sometime. So, Naren, talking a little bit more about investing, talk to us about investing in times of war or investing in times of border tensions, like let's say a country like India, right? Our borders are a little, you know, ruffled. Or you look at Russia, Ukraine, they've had a full-blown war. When you think of one is a current war happening, or you think of the future where you think that, you know, the wars may play out or the, you know, tensions may play out. How do you factor that in? Or do you factor that in all at all in your decision-making process?
It's not possible because we know nothing about what will happen in a war. So if valuation is very cheap, just don't bother too much.
So you're really bottom up. You're looking at the company level and looking beyond.
You look at the market level also. Valuation of the market is equally important. One of the things which I tell my colleagues also is when bad news is there, markets will be cheap. When good news is there, markets will be costly. I don't think you're going to get bad news and markets being expensive and good news and markets being very, very cheap. If you're going to get that, it's very unlikely. So you're going to get the combination of bad news and bad share prices, good news and good share prices. So you basically, again, I would say when we get the benefit of slow, gradual buying because we have got large sums of money. So we are able to do that gradually. So we don't over worry about it every day. In fact, the frameworks that we have in the asset allocator fund of fund that we have or something like that. Everything we believe in gradual. Gradual models work much, much better because we don't know when the market will bottom out. we didn't know on March 8, 2009 that the market bottomed out.
Yeah.
We would not have known that market peaked in January 2008. So these things we know in retrospect. So what we've learned over a period of time is gradual models work better because none of us can predict the bottom, none of us can predict the top accurately. But if you do gradually, you give an investing experience which is reasonable for other people's money. In any case, trying to aim to give the best ever return possible never works. So as long as you give a reasonable experience, it looks okay. So yeah, that's what we aim for, and we don't even aim to give the best ever experience.
Yeah. So I really like what you said in the context that if I was to do a poll right now, if I could do a poll right now and ask people, would you invest in a fund which is large or which is small, right? And assuming the performance is the same, most people would opt for the smaller fund because for some reason there's a bias. A small fund manager can generate a larger return over time. But I think what I'm hearing from you is that large funds can also have an advantage because there is a automatic, systematic investing process built in, which really de-risks the fund in some senses. So sharp swings, you know, are less likely to happen, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, see, we can never aim to do we never know what is the top. We never know what is the bottom, you know, because finally the top and bottom is created by emotions of the investors. They are not created by logic. They are created by emotions of investors, and the emotions of the entire investing community can never be understood by us.
Yeah, and that's a futile effort to try and get that. Okay, moving on from war. Talk to us about investing in times of inflation. Now, I know you've already clarified, you look at valuations, etc. But just how do you think about it? Inflation playing out all around the world. So you can answer it at two levels, at a very fundamental level. And if you have a view on the current environment, on how inflation is playing out, how do you see it playing out? You know, that'll be great too.
See, throughout 2020, we were very positive March to May, June 2020. Then we were very, very cautious. Wow. June, July, August, September 2020. In September 2020, we realized we are going wrong. When we realized that it was a central bank bull market, and we even gave interviews to this effect that the biggest fund manager today is Mr. Jerome Powell and not any fund manager in India. And we gave interviews to that effect. And the day Jerome Powell woke up in November 2021 and said, I'm going to turn the taps off. After that, markets have changed. So frankly, they have created this inflation. So they have to put the inflation back out. So again, it's very difficult for us to predict when they're going to put it off. It's a very tough task. Frankly, if you ask me, it'll happen. But during this period, markets are going to be very volatile. So what we tell people is do systematic investing or do asset allocation, because it's tough to say how the inflation will go down. We know that goods inflation may have peaked, but what is going to happen to services inflation? Because you're not printed ordinary sums of money. You have printed maybe $20 trillion of money all over the world. When you have printed this kind of money, you know how much leakage has happened to services inflation, we won't even know. So all you can do is you can again do systematic investing and you can do asset allocation. These are the two things you can do because central banks have believed that you can print money and there will be no side effect.
No consequences.
Yeah, if consequences were not there from 1948, why did they not print money? Why did they start printing money after 2008? You could have printed money from 2008. There has to be side effect, and that side effect we have to see the negative impact of. So I think we are headed in a very, very complicated period where volatility will be higher. But frankly, none of us understand, because the reality is it is only post 2008 this money printing started. Prior to that, there was no money printing. And the central banks thought that even with money printing, there'll be no side effect. That has been proved wrong. Now, but the solutions are clear. from an investor point of view, the solutions are only asset allocation and systematic investing, and hope that there won't be any hyperinflation. That is what I think the Jerome Powell has clearly said, we will fight inflation. But if they keep on increasing interest rates, markets are not going to go up.
They have a credibility issue, so they may go overboard just to prove that they're serious. And I think that's one of the risks. So you mentioned about, about hyperinflation and inflation playing out. So one of the things that a lot of people are thinking about these days is, so do they, because volatility is coming, do they stay in or do they exit? And I think that's another, you know, greed fear response, right? And I'm sure you can explain it much better to our viewers, is that only in hindsight do you know when you should have invested, because most of the money is made in very short periods of time. So if you had exited the markets in March, mid-March, and not invested for the next couple of months, you missed out a bulk of the rally, a lot of the rally. So do you subscribe to that notion? So you just focus on the companies, focus on the valuations, and stay invested and ride it out as long as your overall asset allocation is taken care of?
See, as long as you have a reasonable asset allocation framework, everything is fine. But most people don't have a reasonable asset allocation framework. So in 2020 March, they panicked. Then suddenly in 2021, they start increasing equity. Yeah. So I think the criticality is first a proper asset allocation framework and not to get consumed by the greed and fear of the moment. And I'm really worried that many people get consumed by the greed and fear of the moment. And that is, I think, the biggest challenge at this point of time. That how do you stay disciplined? The biggest challenge of investing is discipline. It's not knowledge. Are you going to be disciplined? Were you disciplined in 1992? Were you disciplined in 94? Were you disciplined in 1999-2000? Were you disciplined in 2007-8-9? Were you disciplined in 2017? Were you disciplined in 2020? There are many, many years where if you were disciplined, you made a lot of money. The issue is discipline. The issue is not about anything else, actually. And to be disciplined, you need to have a right mental makeup. And what is systematic investment plan and asset allocation is that the makeup of those products is that you are disciplined. And if you're disciplined, you make money. And most people are not disciplined. And there are some people who are disciplined, and those people who are disciplined end up making huge monies.
It's a distorted market. Few people make most of the money. That's the reality. I want to talk to you about asset allocation. And I'm hoping you can answer the question two ways. Personally, how do you think of asset allocation? One is from the fund side. We'll talk separately about that. But personally, how do you think about it? And how do you go about it?
See, personally, I'm always looking for an asset class which is bombed out. So if there is an asset class which is bombed out, then I look for an asset class in bubble. These two I keep looking for. And like, you know, in 2013 to 15 period, I felt that in that 11 to 15 period, I felt real estate was in a bubble because everyone around me was only interested in real estate. So I had a flat in Chennai and a flat in Bombay. I sold it and I have given interviews to that effect. So then I look for asset classes which are bombed out. You know, clearly, for example, Chinese equity was one asset class which looked bombed out. So, you know, I look at it. I have seen public sector stocks have been bombed out. So at periods of time, so they look very attractive. So I keep looking for areas which look bombed out, like floating rate bonds at this point of time within the debt spectrum look bombed out. So I keep looking for anything which is bombed out. So then I try to look for all those areas which are bombed out and say those are interesting areas at various points of time. So what is I'll try to tell people whichever is bombed out, invest, whichever is in bubble, sell. Now that is sometimes people find it very difficult. If you had gone and told anyone in 2011-12, get out of real estate, people would have thrown you out. And if I tell anyone today that floating rate category is an interesting category, people say it never delivers. Why should I invest? But that is a framework that we believe in, that always look for categories which is bombed out and look for categories which appear to be in bubble. So, you know, a year back or year and a half back, we used to tell people US equities was overvalued. And we always used to tell people, but at that point of time, people say US will always deliver. But in 2012, in our company, we launched a US equity fund. It collected very low sums of money because 12 years of zero return meant that US equities were almost bombed out. So we had launched a commodity fund in 2018-19 because we thought it was bombed out asset class.
What a great timing, yeah. Great timing to launch a commodities fund.
So that is the framework we believe in. So we look for bombed out asset classes and we look for bubble asset classes. This is what we try to do all the time.
Yeah. So that's the theme that I think underlines everything that you're talking to us today. And it's if you can get rid of your biases, it's such a nice principle to follow, right? Buy what is hated and just exit what is like really loved out there. Really. So personally, of course, you mentioned you exited real estate. And do you have like a thumb rule that you will have some money in gold always, some for expenses? How many years of expenses? Do you do that formally or it's just a result of the investments that you do?
No one is extremely systematic. First of all, I must tell you, it was in 2011 to 15, I was very negative on real estate, not in the recent past. So, you know, everyone is not that systematic, but I believe gold is an asset class which delivers when all other asset classes costly, you should invest in gold. And gold is actually a defensive asset class, which is not an asset class. It doesn't give you interest. It doesn't give you dividend. So you put some amount of money, you know, for a rainy day. So if something else goes wrong, you'll make money in gold. That's how we look at it. So it's a complex asset class. Yeah. Luckily, I never understood crypto. So that is a good thing because we didn't understand crypto. So, and so that...
You're sure the day someone told you about cryptos, it was not your anniversary and you were busy at home? Maybe luck played its role another time. But cryptos, you completely sidestepped as an individual, did not understand, did not buy?
Yeah, I felt that, first of all, I don't even understand gold well. So where do I go from, if I don't understand gold well, where do I go to crypto? So I believe that gold performs the role of crypto for me. And I believe that gold is an asset class which at least has thousands of crores, years of history. So I said, if at all you have to put an allocation, put it in gold. Why put it in crypto? And when you look at many other websites, you have some 15 types of crypto. That made me very worried.
And the worst form are those stable coins, which are like really misleading. But anyways, so we spoke about how luck has played a role in your life in 92 and maybe in the crypto story. I don't know. So, you know, we're all coming off lockdowns, pandemics and all. So, you know, your wife comes to you and says, she probably calls you Sankaran or Naren and says, you know what? I saved up a crore of rupees and here it is. What do you want me to do with it? What would be your advice be to her?
I'll tell her to invest in all the asset classes, equity, debt, gold, international equity at this point of time.
Whatever's most hated. Including a little bit of Chinese equity.
Most hated is right now Japanese equity and Chinese equity.
Yeah.
That would be the most hated at this point of time because those are all asset classes people are not willing to look at all.
Not at all. Yeah. Everyone's, I think, looking for hope. They're hoping that the US markets turn around, but they're not seeing what has fallen and could really do well in the next, you know, many years to come.
I think Japanese equity represents one of the most interesting because not only Japanese equity has never delivered, the Japanese yen has also gone. If you looked at one of the most bombed out asset classes in the world, it is Japanese yen.
Yeah.
It has just fallen like one rocket at this point of time. So if you looked at a bombed out asset class at this point of time, it is yen.
They're going in the opposite cycle for interest rates, right? They're not following the world. So
yeah.
Talk to us about... Let's take Japanese equity for a moment, just for a moment. So I have two questions. One is, if someone had to start, think of, okay, I'm open to the idea of investing abroad. And let's say, for example, he came, zeroed in on, he listened to Naren and said, okay, let me think about Japan. How should one go about studying that more? And how do you suggest one take exposure to a market like Japan?
See, that there are challenges right now. And I don't think this is a product call. So, and there are compliance challenges if I start talking of products in this. So, I would say that, you know, it's very simple. What we have learned is you just look at trailing price to earnings of a market. You look at trailing price to book of a market. You look at dividend yield of a market. You look at market cap to GDP of a market. You compare the dividend yield of a market and compare it with the bond yield of the market. These are all simple ways of looking at valuations of a market. So this is how we. This is how I come to a conclusion that Japanese equity looks cheap.
Yeah. If I'm not, If I'm not mistaken, Buffett took exposure to those trading, trading companies in Japan. Mitsubishi and Marubeni, I know which. Well, everyone's thinking alike right now. Do you follow Buffett?
We follow what they do. Because, you know, see, he has an uncanny ability to sift through a lot of things and say, this is what has margin of safety. And that kind of uncanny ability that he has at that age is just unbelievable for us. I mean, the kind of clarity of thought that Charlie Munger has at his age is something just amazing. It's something that I just can't believe at that age, the clarity that he has.
You know, I always watch the Daily Journal meeting, every minute of it. It is fascinating. And you're right. Even when I'm watching it, I'm just thinking, what presence of mind. It's like unbelievable. And they're so sharp, so abreast. But I like Charlie Munger for his humor as well and for his sharp comments. on cryptos, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So we spoke about, you know, global equities and how you should allocate, etc. Howard Marks, you have a special affinity for Howard Marks.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that. What do you like?
See,
about
basically, Howard? You know, a lot of what we did when the moment. I read oaktreecapital.com and understood his view on cycles and all that. I realized that whatever we are trying to do, he provided the entire theoretical base,
the framework
for whatever we were trying to talk about. So I would say that the entire theoretical framework was beautifully elucidated by him. You know, finally, at the end of the day, there is a clock, there's a pendulum, there's a cycle which moves from extreme fear to extreme greed. It doesn't settle at one level. It moves all the time. The way it works at extreme fear, the way it works at extreme greed, the fact that investing is an uncontrollable function where you can't predict whether it will go to extreme greed or extreme fear, what you should do in extreme greed, what you should do in extreme fear, that it may not go to extreme greed or extreme fear. Everything, there are so many nuggets of wisdom in what he has shared without even putting a single jargon like price to earnings and price to book and return on equity and return on invested capital and return on capital employed in his website. What I really like about it is he has not used any of his jargon in this website. So, you know, it's made life so easy for me to explain this to people. And that's why I admire him. Because at the end of the day, see, we believe in complicating things and making everything look more complex. But finally, you know, investing is finally common sense. And if you want to make money in the long run, if you know how to control your emotions and do things based on common sense, you can make money. But the world wants to make it very complicated so that you can't make money as though it is not common sense, but it is finally common sense.
It is common sense and TED. Think, decide, execute.
Exactly.
Get that to the viewers. Okay. Now I want to talk to you about India. So a little bit current and more crystal ball gazing 5, 10, 20 years. We're talking long trends. What do you, when you think of extremely long-term investing in India, what is the investing case for India that really appeals to you?
See, I think the investing case comes out of people. The fact that, you know, I believe that Indians are very good. And I think the quality of capability of Indians is just too much. And the fact that, you know, if I had to call my colleagues on a Saturday and tell them to work on a Saturday, they will do it. Why do you think the IT industry grew? The IT industry grew because of the fact that people were willing to work much harder than many other parts of the world. And I believe that, you know, the general knowledge capabilities of Indians in being able to change and live through change and live through a lot of uncertainties is phenomenal. So I think the way India has managed to stay a democracy all the way from 1947 and managed to handle, you know, so many inconsistencies between so many parts of the country and stay a democracy has been unbelievable. And so I believe these are the positives I see. The way we have handled the technology change over this period. And, you know, if oil were to become cheaper or oil were to become irrelevant, as what people say, with climate change, India loses all the problems that they had. You know, what was the only problem India had, which was high oil prices? Yep. And if that problem goes away, we are one of the best countries in the world for the long run. And that, I think, is the real positive of India. Having visited many parts of the world, I think the capability of Indians has been proved without doubt across so many things. Yep. And that, I think, is the real reason why I think Indian markets, Indian economy, everything can do well over a period of time, over the next 10, 20 years.
So one of the sort of pillars of India's growth in the future is said to be that we will take away some business from China, or we'll become more competitive in the export market. There's some shift happening. You know, I guess the flag bearer of that is that the iPhone is being made in India, right? Everyone gives that example. Do you see India actually becoming the export powerhouse, like how China became at one point in time?
See, I think as it is, if you look at it, the way the IT boom has happened, the way the pharma boom, the generic drug boom has happened, I believe areas like healthcare services, I don't see why India can't become the healthcare services hub of the world. So I think in all these areas, we have got a natural right to win. As far as manufacturing is concerned, you know, we have to keep working on it. And it's not as if countries like Vietnam or Bangladesh are not working hard. They've also been working hard. So I think it's going to be a competitive effort and we'll do well. But, in areas where we have already done well, I think the competition, I think we will continue to gain there. Mm-hmm. And that's how I see it. It's not going to be that easy in the areas where we have already not won. Because the people who have gained in the recent past include people like Vietnam, where the Chinese may have set up bases and grown. Because China also does not want to naturally hand it over to India.
Yeah.
They want to hand it over to people like Vietnam. And I think that is the reason why countries like Vietnam have done well. So I think India will do well. But in areas like IT services, pharma, and all these places, I think India will do very well.
What's the biggest change that you see at India level from the 80s, you know, when you started your journey in this and now?
It's just unbelievable, actually, because, you know, when I studied in IIT in Chennai, that point of time, everyone had to leave Chennai, come to Bombay for jobs. Today, I can hardly see people leave Chennai or Bangalore and come to Bombay for jobs. In fact, the reverse happens. That's one. Second, if you look at the I mean, you look at the way technology has changed. See the way, you know, the COVID vaccination happened in India. The way the COVID vaccine app happened in India. The way, for example, the entire Aadhaar card has been handled. I mean, these kind of things, I think other countries haven't managed. You know, today I can show the COVID vaccine, what has happened to all my booster dose and my first two dose to anyone so smoothly. I don't think there is any other country in the world where we've been able to do all these things. The way we have managed, we are one of the best payment systems in the world.
UPI.
UPI and NPCI. I think these kind of things are just awesome at this point of time. The kind of digital infrastructure in some of the areas we have created, just awesome. And I don't think we all recognize these things. In India, I think some of my IIT classmates were telling me that in some areas, India is ahead of even US in some of these digital infrastructure things.
Yeah, and you know, and you're right, the change is so dramatic in a way. And I wonder, you know, sometimes that Mr. Nandan Nilekani needs to get many more pats on the back, because he's that, what they call the stack that has been created is a real game changer. Yeah? It's a real game changer. And how many years? It's not even been 10 years.
I think absolutely the support that the government gave the entire stack project has to be completely supported over this period.
Yep. We just spoke about India then and now. What about companies? When you are looking at annual reports then and now?
I think Indian companies are the most stock market focused companies in the world. I think they are very, very focused. They are very shareholder. They always think of the shareholder. In fact, I tell many of the companies, don't focus on the shareholder, focus on the long term. So, and I think as such, having since I look at many of the companies, I think Indian companies are very, very focused, hardworking. They think forward and all that. And I think that from that perspective, there are no challenges. I would say that's one of the reasons why Indian stocks trade at a huge premium to the world at this point of time. The challenge is there to keep continuing to deliver on the growth, because the valuation gap between India and the emerging market indices is so high at this point of time. It's one of the highest ever on record at this point of time.
Wow, I didn't know that. It's very interesting. Yeah.
So that is the challenge, if you ask me. The challenge is not the company. The challenge is the valuation gap between emerging market valuations and India at this point.
And the gap sustains now even after this tens of thousands of crores of FII money moving.
Exactly.
Wow. That says something. There's someone buying at the other end for sure. Otherwise, by now, we would have sold off. Have you ever done some a rough back of the envelope calculation of where India could be 2050?
No, I don't do all that, because you know somehow you tend to get it wrong.
Yeah.
Like you know, when I joined ICICI Mutual Fund, we used to manage 2,000 crores of equity of other people's money. Today we manage more than 2,25,000 crores or so in equity and hybrid schemes. We have more than 4.5 lakh crores, including debt. These kind of numbers we would have never imagined. If you had given me this number in 2004, I would have said, no, not possible.
Yeah.
So one of the things we learn is do the right things for the investor. You keep growing like that, you know, don't give all these forward predictions. That's what people say, 1 lakh Sensex, 2 lakh Sensex. We don't do all that. Try to do the right things for the investor and not give these forward predictions of 2050.
That is correct. I mean, that's good advice. I have one final question for you. We've discussed a whole span of things, but the question I have for you is a very important question. Suppose you bump into Mr. Modi or Ms. Sitaraman at one of your conclaves or get-togethers, and you had the opportunity for giving them some advice. What is the advice you'd give to Mr. Modi, and what's the advice you'd give to Ms. Sitaraman?
I think, you know, Actually, this government, for example, what I can tell you is that in the last, we always get the chance to actually communicate whatever feedback we want by mail to the bureaucrats on any issue that we want to. And that, I think, has been something which we have really found much more openness over the last many years. And, you know, that's really the big advantage that we've seen. And if you look at the growth of the mutual fund industry itself has happened primarily because of the superb regulations that have happened, which has helped the industry grow. So I don't want to give you anything specific because, you know, they have always, the entire regulator and the finance ministry has always taken feedback from players like us over a period of
time. I was thinking you'll say something more exciting than that, but I think it's... Marin, it's been wonderful. And I regret even more I did not meet you 15 years ago, because I could have got a lot of this wisdom even then, because you'd been through all those cycles. So thank you very much for your time. And, you know, I hope, you know, it was a fun hour that you spent with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Equity Master. Thank you. Thank you, Rahul, for all this opportunity and forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Investor Hour. I'm very excited to hear what you have to say about this episode or the podcast in general. Be sure to write to me at info@equitymaster.com. That's info@equitymaster.com. Thank you once again, and see you at the next edition of the Investor Hour.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.